PushLiving.com presents the Wheelchair Accessible Lifestyle Podcast, pushing the boundaries of disability-inclusive design, travel, and lifestyle. Here, you'll find stories of triumph, courage, and clarity. You'll discover you're not alone and hear from inspirational guests from the disability community and beyond. You'll get fresh reviews of the best inclusive travel locations and fabulous products to help make your life more functional, healthy, and fun. We will intrigue, enlighten, and encourage you to live your best life on wheels. Whether you're a wheelchair entrepreneur, a stay-at-home mom or dad, or newly disabled, you will love the advice and ideas we share to help you learn, grow, and push your own boundaries. Now, let's roll.
Hi, this is Deborah Davis, and you are now listening to Push Living's podcast, episode number 3. Today, I am going to be bringing to you an expert in the field of the ADA litigation, Louis Andruin, spelled A-N-D-R-O-U-I-N, is someone who has over 15 years experience in this field. I got to know Louis, I call him Louis, and I'm sure he won't mind if you do as well. When I did a case on the Hollywood Boardwalk about 6 years ago, I had gone there with my two young daughters and found a really cool place to go that I looked up online to take them, a little cheeseburger place, and found out that there was no accessible bathroom. Now, again, this was 6 years ago. The ADA was passed in 1991. So I contacted Louis through a friend, and we litigated. And not only did we change that location, and I won't say the name, but we also found that there were many other locations in that area that also needed to come into compliance with the ADA. So I contacted Louis again recently. We had a lovely lunch in Fort Lauderdale because we have found that even though the ADA has been around and most restaurants are now compliant, that there's a new trend called high tops. These high top tables have become so popular that essentially they're making it so that those of us who use wheelchairs can no longer access restaurants and bars who are using high top tables. So Louis and I are working together on this campaign, and I'm happy to have him here to talk with you today about that, as well as a little bit about, you know, his knowledge and experience and how you also can benefit from someone like him. Louis is considered an expert consultant, and he works with legal teams in providing the type of information that they need to make sure that these cases are won on our behalf. Welcome, Louis.
Thank you, Deborah. May I say, that was a very, very nice introduction. My goodness, very nice. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Well, I am so happy to have you here. You are somebody, like I said, when we had that luncheon, I thought, Louis, I have to get you on a podcast. You know, you have so much passion for what you do. I just love it. And I want to get right to the chase, because I know that a lot of people think that ADA attorneys are not necessarily always in it for the right reasons. And sometimes people see, oh, these constant litigators, or, you know, that they get these plaintiffs and they go in and they sue these businesses, and these poor little businesses are victims of these ADA litigators. Tell me your thoughts about that particular thought process.
Well, that is an excellent topic to actually start off with, because it is something that truly affects all of ADA compliance. For example, when you have a human body that is healthy and it gets a disease somewhere in the body and you don't take care of it, pretty soon other systems in that body that are not breaking down will start breaking down. And it is unfortunate that there are a number of attorneys out there that use the law, the good purposes of the ADA, to make money for themselves and really put access second. And those attorneys are, it's just a terrible thing that's going on. But there are many, many, many attorneys, and the ones whom you know personally through me, and that I would vouch for. And what separates the attorneys that are doing it correctly, in my view, from the attorneys that are doing it, shall we say, incorrectly, a number of things. And they're very apparent, and it's interesting to me that in a lot of times the courts let them get away with it. And the way it happens is, first of all, let me take your question in two parts. Regarding the businesses that are sued, okay, for noncompliance with the ADA, Well, whether they're sued by a shyster attorney, these guys who are doing it incorrectly, or they're sued by the correct attorney, the fact is they're getting sued because they're inaccessible. They have a business operating that is violating the ADA. I can assure you that these lawsuits are not brought against businesses that are actually in compliance. So what happens is that they get caught and now they get sued. So I have very little sympathy for businesses that over 20 plus years past the effective date of the ADA continue to engage in discriminatory practices and policies by having architectural barriers and by having policies that restrict service animals and just make it difficult all around. That said, we can now look at the prosecution of these ADA cases. Mm-hmm. And what I can say that separates the good prosecutors from the bad prosecutors, the prosecutors that are doing it correctly, and I will state unabashedly that I am doing it correctly. I have no doubt that I am, because I am. Okay? And go ahead.
No, I'm just laughing because I love your personality and your zest.
Okay, well, I mean, because really, that's my pride. They can take everything away from us. They can't take that.
That's right.
What separates the good ones from, shall we say, the bad ones are a number of things that it really boils down to a sense of purpose. It really is a sense of purpose. The way that I like to see a litigation proceed to achieve access at a place is that the place is non-compliant, the attorney files the lawsuit, the attorney, they immediately realize they're not compliant, and rather than hire, though they have to hire an attorney, but rather than hire an attorney to go in and spend $20,000 worth of legal fees litigating and try and fix the place haphazardly in the hopes that they can get the case dismissed or just litigate for the sake of litigating, I would much rather see that these defendants realize they're not compliant, immediately call the prosecuting attorney for the plaintiff and say, hey, look, we don't want to fight. We want to enter an agreement. Stop the bleeding right now before the fees go any further. At that point, the fees, the expert fees, the attorney fees are minimal. And when those things happen, those cases are resolved very well and things turn out well. And I can tell you that I have been hired by many, many defendants. And my advice to them is exactly the same. It is no different because that is the best advice. And in fact, I can tell you that I can always tell when the actual attorney or the defendant is an attorney who's a friend or has a personal relationship with that defendant, as opposed to an attorney that's been hired just for this case and never knew this attorney before. Because the ones that have a relationship with their defendant client tend to do these cases perfectly, like immediately. They settle the case right away. They get a year and a half to fix the property. They get to take advantage of two fiscal years of IRS credits of $15,000 per year for the modifications. They don't spend all these thousands of dollars on legal fees for both their attorney and the prosecuting attorney, which is how it works in the ADA. These cases, wonderful. And then the important thing that has to occur is at the end of that case that's been done correctly until that moment, mm-hmm. when they go before the judge and say to the judge as the last act in the case, Your Honor, we have come to an agreement. Here's the agreement. The property is going to be ADA compliant to the maximum extent feasible, required for a pre-existing facility, and therefore we want you to dismiss this case. However, only if you retain jurisdiction to enforce this final agreement. And then the court says 100% of the time, okay, on that basis, I will dismiss this case with prejudice, subject to the court retaining jurisdiction to enforce the agreement. That case has turned out beautifully. Now, let me tell you how the bad attorneys do these cases, okay?
Okay.
First of all, yeah, I question my own question. They go in on basically the same kind of basis. I mean, they don't pull these things out of their ear, and that's ear with an E. There are barriers, so they sue the place. And now the place says, well, we're not sure, or we want to settle right away. Well, these guys are not going to settle right away. What they're going to do is they're going to insist on additional inspection. They're going to, that may or may not be necessary. If it's necessary, then it's not a bad move. But if it's like if you have a hotel, if you're suing a hotel for access, mm-hmm. and you know where the violations are in the public area, these have been able to be documented by the expert using, you know, a stealth inspection. but you haven't been able to get into all the different types of rooms and private areas that need to be compliant pursuant to the ADA. In a case such as that, once the case is filed, you would go in and request what's known as a Rule 34 inspection. But normally, if you sue a restaurant, you sue these types of smaller facilities that are not overwhelming, these things can be documented in one visit, and you don't need to really go back. And therefore, that would also assist the defendant in coming to an agreement, because if you're going to force an inspection, which you're entitled to do, they're going to have to now hire their expert. They're going to have to get their attorney to go to that inspection. The whole thing starts to snowball. And these other attorneys, they know how that this operates this way. And that's just a shame. But the worst thing that they do is at the end of the case, say they do in fact come to a decent agreement, the type of agreement that will create substantial access, although I'm not happy with that phrase, substantial access, because there's access, there's no access. But just for the sake of this conversation, describing their less than stellar performance, let's say that they did enter into an agreement that ordered the defendant to comply with that agreement, that facility would be substantially accessible, better than it was before. Okay, we could say somewhat, okay, wonderful. The problem is that when they go before the court as that last act, as that last moment that they're going to tell the court all the beautiful things that they did to resolve this case and create full access, and I've got to tell the court it's substantial, full access, and the court, relying on both parties' representations, says, okay, they will not ask the court to retain jurisdiction over the agreement. And when they do that, what happens is that the court automatically dismisses the case. Court is not going to ask them, you know, should I read that? No. Okay, it's almost a self-executing process unless you state that you can only dismiss contingent upon your retained jurisdiction. If you don't say that, the process is self-executing and the door is closed. So, and then what happens when that has occurred are two things. First of all, no one's ever going to enforce that agreement. Because in order to enforce that agreement, you can't go back to federal court. You can't go back before that judge. You have to now go and start a brand new action in state court to enforce a contract. And I can assure you that all these bad attorneys that were willing to take on these cases up front to do the ADA and get some attorney fees are not going to want to get involved in this contract issue in Florida State Court. And in fact, they don't. So it's very easy to determine which are the good attorneys and which are the bad attorneys, in my view. And all you have to do is look at the ancient, any case any attorney has done, go to the one of the last acts in every case is the order of dismissal by the judge. It's usually the last act on the docket sheet. And that will say, if it says this case dismissed with prejudice, blah, 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 and that's all, then you know that that attorney is just really, he's one of those bad guys. If you go down to that order and you see case dismissed with prejudice, the court retains jurisdiction to enforce the party's agreement, you know those people did it right. And the last thing I would say, and it's very short, is that at the last, regardless of whether a defendant is sued by a shyster, or when I say shyster, I don't really want to use that word, they could come down on me, not that I'm afraid of, you're a bad attorney or a good attorney, let's say, the amount of resources that are going to be spent by all the parties, truly though, is always, always, always in the hands of the defendant. The defensive posture is the one that sets the tone of the case. So although the shyster attorneys may make a couple of, may try to do a couple of stupid moves in the beginning with a defendant who wants to settle right away, for the most part, they also want to get out of the case right away because they get their fees right away and have to do any more work. So, okay, they got other fish to fry. So I would say that as the last thing, because I don't really want to give the impression that defendants are off the hook on this. The defendants oftentimes are, and I understand, I've worked with defendants. They're angry that they've been sued. They oftentimes, they never realized that they were non-compliant. They thought that they got their certificate of occupancy and had all their licenses together and everything else was in order, that everything was then hunky-dory as far as whatever these aspects are concerned. And they are oftentimes shocked and surprised. And they didn't really have an intent to discriminate. And I can tell you that even after they're sued, they still are wondering, why have I been sued? I remember one time in Key West, and we were with Michael, whom you know, and we're up on this, it's like four steps up, not even one step, not even two, it's four steps up, and in this store that was a very popular store, and we managed to get Michael up there in the wheelchair, and the owner of the store actually said, and he didn't mean it, he actually said, "I don't understand why I'm being sued. No one in a wheelchair has ever come in this store." So when you hear things like that from people that you can see in real time, they're not angry, they really are, you know, scratching their heads. The ignorance, it's always the defendant that really sets the tone. So if they want to settle quickly, they sure. And I counsel all business owners. Oftentimes I'm called ahead of time. A business is going to open and they've gotten all the permits that they've heard from the neighboring businesses or wherever, that they better be careful because the permits don't mean anything and you are still going to be subject to, or you may be subject to a lawsuit for ADA compliance. So they get my number, they call me and I go and I do an assessment. And even places that are brand new, that have all their licenses and certificates and permits in order, didn't miss a beat, that have their issues, brand new construction. And we also know there are places that are sued 6 years ago, and that's another thing about these lawsuits that hurt the ADA when they don't retain jurisdiction to enforce. Aside from, you know, what I see as defensive, offensive issues between the two. That's what I see between defense attorneys and plaintiff attorneys in those kind of cases, kind of winking and nodding that it's okay, don't ask for jurisdiction, for retention, enforcement jurisdiction. There is also the issue that there are many times when these cases arise, and for example, I was told by a law firm, "Mr. Andrewi, please go to such and such hotel, and we've heard that there are problems there with access, and wanna, before we file a suit, we want you to verify the violations," which is the first step in filing the lawsuit after we're informed. And then after I go, I realize, yes, there are many violations here. And as part of the process, I look to see what has gone on in the past. Has this entity, has this owner, has this location, have any past owners ever been sued in federal court for the ADA violations? And I can't tell you how many times I come up on that. And when I come up on that, I can't tell you how sadly, how many times I look at that final order of dismissal and there's no retention of jurisdiction. And it's usually the same characters. This is what bothers me. It's like, you know who's doing this. It's not everybody. It's just one little, you know, tiny little morsel group that's like doing this bad thing. So when that happens, the attorney who was at first willing to take on this case is now not going to want to do it because now these cases are difficult enough. Now you tell me it's a prior agreement. Now we're going to have to jump through those hurdles. Now we're going to have to do this. Oh, my God. That's how they think, and rightly so, because after all, good or bad, it's all a business, too. You know, they went to law school. They have to make their money. They have to pay their bills. Everybody's not doing this for free. It's not all altruistic.
Absolutely.
But really, so you have all these issues that arise, so they don't want to do a prior agreement. However, when a prior agreement does have retention of jurisdiction, then as you know, Deborah, it works out a little differently for the defendant. They have to do it. But even there, recently, without getting into details, you witnessed how, what you would think is a slam dunk, that what you would think that the defendants would realize, you guys are dead. You know, oh my God, I'm dead. Okay, I signed an agreement years ago. I promised to do all these modifications within X amount of time, which was a year. And now, 8 years later, I haven't done anything. And in fact, I took out accessible tables and put in high tops because high tops became popular. And now, they don't realize that. They try and fight the second suit too, but you see it works out. Which, by the way, I think was a good segue into high tops.
Yes. So basically, you know, what you're saying is that lawyers, there are some reasons why businesses, and you read it in the news all the time about the ADA shysters, to use your term. And you've explained it so well, because I don't think most of our audience really understood that. What the deal is that an ADA attorney can go in, sue a facility, a building, a restaurant. It could be any type of public access entity, and they will collect the attorney's fees for the prospect of suing them. They will agree to do that. Okay, you pay me such and such for my time and effort in suing you, but they will not care whether or not that restaurant or facility ever does anything to make the actual changes. So they just go away, and it's kind of like a payoff. I'm just going to go away now. And I got my attorney's fees. Now, you know, the entity can say, you know what? I just paid $8,000, $10,000 or whatever it may be. I'm not going to spend any more money actually fixing the issues. Whereas a good attorney, and we have a great expert like you, will make sure that not only will you pay me for having to have had to sue you because you should have known better. It's not a case of I didn't know any better. It doesn't work with taxes, and it certainly doesn't work with ignorance of the law. It doesn't work in ADA cases either. They need to go in. Not only do they have to pay now for someone who had to take the time to show them that they were here at fault, to hire the experts to show them how they were at fault and how they could actually correct those issues, but now we want to make sure that you have a year or two to enforce them. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. You know, most people are under the impression, as you stated, that the problem, like when you see these interviews on TV, the layperson is under the impression that the problem is all these attorneys filing multiple lawsuits.
Right.
So, but that is not the problem. Because, for example, if I were being interviewed, if I were stopped on the streets by Dan Rather in the old days of 60 Minutes or whoever would be doing it today and saying, excuse me, Mr. Andrew, we understand that you're one of the foremost ADA consultant experts in South Florida and, in fact, in many of these regions, and that you are creating all kinds of problems and that you are really taking advantage of small business like all these lawsuits your legal teams are filing. My response would not be defensive. It would not be to cower and to try and make excuses for those lawsuits. My response would be, well, you know what? I am remiss because we have not filed enough. We don't have enough time in the day, and we're looking to file more because these places have to come into compliance. So the problem is not at that point. The problem is, as you said, at the end point, where they enter into an agreement, and now they didn't retain jurisdiction. They make the agreement confidential. You never know what the agreement is. The new attorneys are very, rightly so, hesitant to get involved in cases with prior agreements. And this is the problem, not the number of lawsuits, but the manner in which they are ultimately settled.
Exactly. That's an excellent point. So how does one, you know, here I am, let's say I'm someone, one of the listeners, and I go with my mom or my father, or my boyfriend, my child. I go to a restaurant and I can't get in. All the tables are bench seatings and none of the seats have ways that I can actually fit a wheelchair up to the table. And I'm like, you know, this isn't really fair. You know, this restaurant has been around for a long time. Or they have those really cool outdoor seats now that where they're like swings where people, you have to climb up into them. Those are really annoying.
Well, see, this is a significant problem, but I have to say that it's a problem that's been around for a long time, not necessarily high tops specifically, but inaccessible tables and inaccessible locations within restaurants and improper dispersal. So we can address this in two parts. The first part is the historical part, which is that the reason why there have been guidelines for accessible tables long before high tops became so prevalent. Even high tops weren't really even a consideration when the guidelines came out. But the guidelines were needed because regardless of the fact that high tops were still not ever present, you didn't have accessible tables. Or you didn't have accessible locations. You would walk into a restaurant and you'd see, like, the first level is pretty cool. But, oh, my God, there's that level over there where all the action is. And, oh, you can't get there. So that's your first problem. And then you get to that level finally, perhaps, and now none of the tables are accessible. And not because they're high tops. We're talking now, you know, 90s and early 2000s. No, because all the tables have either benches or they have the big pedestals with the round that go almost of the length of the width of the whole table. Just inaccessible all over. So they came up with a guideline regarding access to an area of primary function, which would be normally a place that is pre-ADA existing. If you have a mezzanine level and you have a base level, say a first level, and the mezzanine level is not the level where all the action is, it's really just a mezzanine level. In those cases where the amenities and the environmental aspects, the accommodations that you went to the restaurant to enjoy are available at the first level, then they've met their burden. But if you have a situation where that level has all the action, then that has to be accessible. And they came up with guidelines for accessing that level. And they also came up with the guidelines for what needs to be accessible, the number of tables that need to be accessible. And back in 1991, when this law was passed, became effective in 1993, they decided that 5% of all the tables in a restaurant would have to be accessible in an area, would have to be accessible in an area of a restaurant. It would have to be properly dispersed if there's more than one area. If you have a patio, for example, you have to have one out there. But never less than one in case you had a real tiny place. And so it was based on the number of tables.
Yeah.
So that's okay if you have 100. But you could see that it's not that many tables, okay?
Right.
It's not a lot of tables, okay? All right. So now, fast forward, and by 2010, the new guidelines came out, and they realized that that really was not addressing the problem, because you know we just kind of raised the percentage of tables. Then you're dealing with spatial issues that are big because tables are big, bigger than the human individual person. And so what they came up with was rather than 5% of the total number of tables, they changed it to 5% of the total number of standing and seating spaces. So that it changed the matrix as to how you figure it out, because you have to figure it out in terms of human spatial areas and standing and seating and flow in a bar and the maximum occupancy. But what it did, by doing that, it made it easier for the disabled community to assert a little more inclusion and not just have some little table somewhere and have, for example, nice tables that are inaccessible that go with the type of motif, so to speak, that a particular restaurant might want to project, and then have some throwaway little table that you wouldn't even use to whatever on the side that looks very, very different, and that's going to be the accessible table. And that, of course, always reminded me of, you know, when I was 11 years old for the first time traveling from New York to Miami by car with my parents and traveling through the South, and I saw those signs, you know, black and white, water fountain, right, colored and white. You know, so that's what happened. So now, here we are. That's a new thing, and that concerns the industry. Another thing is, they changed the bar rule. There was a rule that in the original guidelines that came out in 1993, mm-hmm, that a bar could have an accessible table near the bar that would provide the same amenities and the same line of sight, for example, to TVs, and if there were gambling machines, or whatever, at an accessible table near the bar would suffice. And in 2010, that has changed. And in 2010 now, you have to have a lower counter. That's why that place we recently did in Hollywood with coming into compliance is getting a lower counter. They're putting in a whole new bar because they have to have a lower counter. So,
well, it's just to put it in a little bit of perspective for our audience what that he means when he says segregation. I mean, let me just tell a quick story of how Louie and I came back together. I had a group of girlfriends, about five of us. I actually did a story about it on pushliving.com. You might want to just do a search for high tops, and you'll see the story. But a group of five girls, we all went out, and they made reservations at a really high-end restaurant. You know, kind of fun, where there's a lot of people hanging out. You know, a hip kind of downtown Fort Lauderdale location. So I go with my five girlfriends, and all of them are able-bodied. I'm the only wheelchair user. And we first get there, and like Louis said, the very first floor where all the action is, we were escorted through. The bar area, I expect to be higher, you know, higher seating. I mean, that's typical. At an actual bar, there's always going to be the higher seats. But then the tables around the bar, all high tops. It's like, okay, so they escort us through there to the actual dining area. The dining area had two rows of tables on the right and the left side. We walked through every single one of those tables, were up a step on benches. Not just benches where I could pull into, but benches that were raised platform benches. So we had to be rolled through there. Now she says to us, now you in the wheelchair, there's an elevator in the back that you need to go up, but the rest of your party's going to follow me and they're going to go up the stairs to the front. So there wasn't an elevator that we all could get on and go up. There was a small little elevator, and it had to be operated by them. So I go up this tiny little elevator being operated by them. I meet my friends upstairs, and the upstairs area is basically the kind of place where people want to go who don't want to be seen, don't want to be part of the fun and the action. You just want a quiet little area overlooking where all the action is. So you can imagine my depression and my friends, because they're with me and now I'm requiring them to go sit somewhere. And I felt as if I was segregated. I felt like, okay, that's the area where it's accessible. The rest of the entire restaurant is not accessible to anyone in a wheelchair. So I just felt that there was something wrong with that. And sure enough, there is. So I contacted Louie again. And I said, Lou, I'm really upset. You know, this whole issue, it's not just the high tops now. It's these high-raised bed seating. The next really popular restaurant that's the walking distance from the one we're at, that, you know, downtown Fort Lauderdale, the girls get out of one place, they go down the street, you go into another. Exactly the same situation, Louie. I walk in, every single table was high benches all along the peripheral of the restaurant, and there was nothing else except standing room around the bar. So again, there was no place for me to sit. And I have a photo of that also on Push Living under the examples of high top tables or inaccessible locations. So, you know, I contacted Lou. I said, we've got to do something about this. It's just becoming a design trend, whereas I guess it's hip. And then when I started posting about it, we found that everybody, there were so many people who were not people in wheelchairs who hated the high top tables and hated the high top chairs. They were uncomfortable. They didn't like them. They hurt their back. They were difficult to get up on. They just, for whatever reason, they just wanted their feet planted on the floor and it made them feel happier. So it's not just me. It's everywhere I go, I hear these stories. So they're essentially making it difficult for anyone who might be overweight, anybody who might be a little shorter, anybody who might have a little bit of a bad back or balance issue. And of course, anybody who sits in a wheelchair, you're basically told you're no longer able to visit this restaurant and enjoy the amenities. We do have a table, however, inside the restaurant or out in the back or somewhere where nobody is, where you might be able to find a table that's lower for you. So the law was saying, as long as you have 5%, it doesn't matter where those 5% are. They were just putting them somewhere, you know, just like the handicap rooms in the hotels. They have them, but they're never with the best views, right? So Louie and I are working together on this campaign. And Louie, tell me about how you feel that there's hope for us and how we can make some real changes here.
And may I say that, that this high top issue specifically, you know, in my earlier, in this segment, in this part about in the table segment that we're doing here earlier, I was talking about regular tables being inaccessible. Regular, I mean, regular, a tall table, you know, regular 36 inches above the ground, waist level tables or less that were inaccessible because you couldn't get under them, you couldn't get to them, whatever. And in those types of establishments, in those types of cases, it was very easy to convince the defendant to go out and get a similar table and just change it for one that a person in a wheelchair can access, get under, okay?
Right.
That wasn't a big deal to them. And because it was really just substituting one type of table for another, basically the same, okay?
Mm-hmm.
When we're talking about high-top tables, we're entering into a new realm that has a different consideration for the defendant. The high-top tables are popular because they show that they generate more income, they generate more flow, they generate more back and forth, they generate business, they generate money. And they also are trying to do them in the classrooms now, because there are some classrooms, there are some educational professionals that are advocating for high-top tables in classrooms because it creates more of a flow. And there are studies to show that, in fact, it does. But, of course, they're not considering the effect that that has, the discriminatory effect that it has in excluding individuals that are not able to access a high-top table. Are you kidding me? And so when I address this issue, by the way, just not to get sidetracked on that particular thing, like the classroom high-top tables, it was brought up by a highly regarded educator, highly, highly regarded. And I communicated directly with her, and she acknowledged that I was correct. And that they would, and I told her, you can't have 5% of the tables be okay. And so really what you're saying is everybody else is up and you're down. And that child is down there. And so she understood that. So they're going to do changes. That's not going to happen. I think she's not going to be behind that. She's not going to be with that program. But we get to bars. Bars, you know, they are interested in money. So what they're going to do is, when you tell a bar that has not just the look that they want with all these visual high tops that to them look like beautiful, okay, when you tell them, by the way, forget about that beauty, how you think it's beautiful. On top of that, you're not even going to change it. You have to, like, really, these two over here got to come down. They're like, what? Not only the visual, I'm going to lose money. And so why is that? All these issues come up. So that doesn't mean that these things, that these cases don't have merit. They have merit, and they're very winnable. It's just that it's new. And like all new, what happens is that this has not happened yet, that places get sued simply for high-top tables or for inaccessible tables.
Right.
The reason that doesn't happen is because you sue a place for an inaccessible table, and they fix it the next day, then that case is dismissed, and the attorney loses the filing fee, doesn't get paid, the whole thing happens. So they have to be convinced that this is a case worth having because the issue is so great, and in fact, it's not just fixing one table. This place is going to go in, you know what, when they have to change those two tables. They're not ever going to do it voluntarily. They're going to fight tooth and nail. And then you'll get the change, and then you'll set the precedent, and then you'll be able to move on, and we'll be able to start slowly diminishing their impact. But I tell you this, unless there is a change in Congress, you're not going to see them eliminated, unless somehow bartenders convert to some type of altruistic awareness, of which in my long history of knowing nightclub owners in New York, that I just don't see that ever happening. So we're just going to have to do this in such a way that the impact spreads out. So that is why the places, the first places that are targeted have to be really, really correct in which places are picked. I don't like to use the word targeted, but really we're targeting places that are engaged in discriminatory conduct by not having accessible seating for their patrons who are disabled, or not having sufficient disabled seating for their patrons who are disabled, or not having it dispersed properly. And
so in other words, if you, it happens every time I go out now, Louis. I send Louis now text photos every single time I go out. I can go to an outdoor restaurant where there's a party being held by a group of people. The entire outdoor bar area, the bar itself and all the tables around, and with the view of the water, all inaccessible to me. The only tables that are accessible are inside where the party isn't being held. I go to another place where we go to a tiki bar and we're on our way down from an event. Again, all the tables on the outside, all high top tables. I am directed to the back where there's low tables in the sun, and it's not where I want to be.
I remember a place that I saw you in a photo where the accessible table was out in the sand.
Oh, yeah. The accessible table. It was a bench table, and it was out down a little curve and in the actual dirt in the sand. I was like, okay, so all the tables that are under the tiki hut where the shade is, where everybody is, overlooking the water, no, you can't be there. And so it's really becoming an issue, even where we have patio bars lining the streets now in Las Olas, one after another, where they used to be regular tables that I could sit at. Now, maybe people in wheelchairs couldn't get under them all the way, but at least if you had to, you could go to the side of them. You could still sit there and have a conversation eye to eye. Now, all of those are being switched out to high tops. I went to a restaurant last night, and they switched out three tables to high tops. Actually, two nights in a row, two different places had switched out a portion of the tables to high tops. And we're talking about restaurants that are very, very popular. It's hard to get a seat. So you can imagine you go in there and the only seat that's available are one of the high tops. So now I'm excluded from sitting there unless I tell somebody else to move.
Right.
So it really puts everybody in a really awkward position. And
what about if you go with your friends to a place and they want to go to this place that's on the places next to each other or right near each other. They want to go to this place on the left, but the place on the left doesn't have any accessible seating or even access. And so now they're in the awkward position of, you're in the awkward position of having your friends, like this or your friends say, okay, we'll go to this place over here, Deborah, no problem. But you know that's not cool. And that's not cool. What's not cool is that place and those tables. And we get it.
And it's funny because I was talking to this gentleman the other day who's in a wheelchair. He's one of our models for Photo Ability, or he will be soon. And we had a meeting at a restaurant to talk about business and life, et cetera. And he goes, oh, yeah, you know, I go to this such and such a bar downtown all the time with the guys after work. And I'm like, oh, I've been there and such and such a bar. All the tables are high tops. And I said, and I had to order my food. We had a girls' event. Again, and I had to order my food, and I had to put my food on the seat of a high-top chair. And I said, in order to even access it, because the table was so high that I couldn't even reach up high enough to see my food to reach it. He goes, yeah. He goes, but I'm used to it, and they never see anybody in wheelchairs there. And I looked at him. I'm like, excuse me? They never see anybody in wheelchairs there? You just told me that you go there all the time. So don't
worry. Deborah, I should introduce him to that owner of that place in Key West who never saw a person in a wheelchair in that place.
That's the thing. It's like, you know, that is something that people have been saying since the ADA was founded. And I never forgot John Stossel, who went on 60 Minutes and did this big expose about how all these companies were going to be hurt by the ADA and that there nobody ever seen anybody in a wheelchair before. But let me ask you, audience, even those of you who are in wheelchairs, when you go out, you see people in wheelchairs all the time. And let's get honest. I mean, the reason why we were never out anywhere is because nothing was accessible. And in order to get in, we had to be lifted upstairs. We couldn't go to the bathroom. Now we have accessible bathrooms. And in Dade County, we have the most accessible bathrooms in the world. The code is the most stringent in the world. Florida's awesome anywhere you go. We could get into bars and restaurants, but now all of a sudden we can go to bars and restaurants. You want to go on a date, you walk in and all the tables are high tops. So you're forced to sit and look up at your date the whole time while he's sitting on a stool and your head is at his knees. Not comfortable, not something that we should be put in the position of having to deal with, but it's almost like we have to fight the ADA all over again. So we're thankful to people like Louis who know what they're doing and do it right. But this is a situation, like you said, that, you know, we have to do it because we're setting precedents, right, Louis? I mean, these...
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's why it's very important to be right out of the gate, because let's say that you come out and they raise the defenses regarding, well, we don't have to get rid of more than just one high top table, and that's it. And it doesn't say what it has to be. It just says it can't be isolated, or they can use these. So if we come out of the gate with a ruling that's against what we're asserting, that's it. And he's going to be excited all over the country.
That's
and
fantastic.
That would just be horrible. In cases that I've been involved with, that I've been cited all over the country, I've always been on the correct winning side, not the side. But, you know, you brought up a very good three-dimensional point for me in my head that I really hadn't looked at it that way. I was just looking at it, whether it's too tall, it's inaccessible. But the actual human interaction is different at an inaccessible table that is not a high top as opposed to an inaccessible table that is a high top. Because at least at a table that's not a high top, albeit it's not accessible, you still have to be, like, on turning the side, you can't get underneath it or something, you're still at more or less eye level with your partner.
Right.
When you're at a high top, it's not just that you are not able to utilize the table or participate in the same manner, and it's awkward, but you are actually, in your human interaction, you're staring at his knee. I mean, that picture that in my mind, that's very powerful. So if I'm ever asked to describe something like that, this is the analogy I would use. It crystallizes why when they're talking about 5% inaccessible tables, and this was before the era of high tops, and where even if the table was inaccessible, you were still able to be more or less next to your partner at the same eye level.
Well, and you were able to eat. I mean, you were able to, you know, it's harder for people who have less trunk ability, trunk, you know, mean core strength, i.e. a quadriplegic or just someone who has weakness of the trunk. It's harder to eat when you're sideways than if you're under the table and, you know, you can be directly over your food, certainly. But, you know, it didn't really prevent us from being a part of the scene, from talking to other people. I mean, when I went to that place with all the girls, and I mean, I was humiliated. And I'm not kidding. And it takes a lot
of time.
Who's been in a wheelchair as many years as I have to be humiliated. But I was really humiliated because, I mean, I felt awkward and I felt, you know, everybody was standing. And it's, I went to a conference, a TED Talk recently at downtown Boca, and it was a big convention hall and all the places to eat. It was part of the TED Talk. It was like a 4-hour event. And then we would break for dinner. Well, guess what? All the tables offer the break for dinner and were all standing room only tables, all high tops with no seats, but standing. So I couldn't even interact with people and have dinner with my fellow TED Talkers. It was just a bad scene all the way around. And it's the ignorance and the complete lack of understanding that we even exist anymore is something that I think we need to take a look at. And one of the things I'd like to do is, once we do set some of this legal precedence with your help and your team of legal eagles who are working with us on these cases, then, you know, to go to the restaurant associations, to go to the designers and say, listen, just be aware, the architects, be aware that this case law exists, and don't put your clients in this position when you're building something new. Don't take away existing tables and put them in. Like you said, it's got to be, they have to know that it's wrong. And I don't mind going and doing public speaking and making sure they're aware at these groups and explaining, you know, what it feels like and why it's important. You know, it's not just me. Again, it's if you're a parent with a disability or...
Here's what's wrong, Deborah. What's wrong is not for them to build high-top tables and to place them. At least it's not illegal. What's illegal and what's wrong is for them to have it so that they do it in such a way that they create a discriminatory atmosphere and that they actually do discriminate, that they don't have... They make it so that you're sitting there and you have no option, and that they don't provide the necessary options. And even when they perhaps provide an option, it's messed up, really. Or it's so limited that it serves as inappropriate, or it's really no option at all. These are the things that we have to change. We're not going to get rid of high tops. If we even try to do that, we're going to lose out of the game.
To get rid of high tops because, frankly, you know, my take on it is very simple. If you were to take and say all people of a certain religion or a certain color or a certain sex, all of you people have to sit in that area over there, and all the regular people can sit in this area over here. It's essentially the same thing, Louis. You're saying anybody in a wheelchair has to sit there, and you're limited to the number of seats you can sit in. Frankly,
well, I have to tell you that the case law is already established. I think the issue you're trying to say, for example, is if you walk into a place and that the entire place has to be compliant in terms of all the tables, so that there's absolutely no need for an accessible table or a section. Oh, this in this area here, in a small restaurant, this is what's accessible. The whole place has everything. And I can tell you that the case law is established on that, and that's just not so.
But
that's what I say would be a losing argument.
I understand it's a losing argument, but universal design is something that we could still advocate for. Universal design is a design that says that it's usable by most people. So, you know, when people go to school to be interior designers and the ones who are actually drawing up these plans, if we can speak to them and we can try to get them to advocate for universal design, all-inclusive design, so we don't even have to face this type of situation.
Well, but then again, you're saying every table should be accessible and there should be no high tops. There should be no, for example, are you saying then that's going the opposite direction? Hold on a second.
Well, like you said, though, Louis, there's a difference between
not being
accessible.
Hold on. Let's go in the opposite direction. Let's say instead of high tops, you go to a Taiwanese restaurant where they have the section where you can go and take off your shoes and crawl along and get under one of those tables or whatever where you're either in the lotus position or you can actually put your feet down, but you're sitting on the ground because they have a hole under the table. So those tables would be illegal. The universal design concept, at its core, is that you enter an environment and that the environment is accessible to those with disabilities. It doesn't mean that every single aspect of the environment has to be accessible to those with disabilities, because then people that do not have disabilities that could actually partake in some manner in aspects that they're not limited, disabilities they do have don't limit them in other ways. They can't do that in a public accommodation, because this has been addressed many times, and it's a hard pill for the judges to swallow, which is why it's been always treated. You see what I mean?
I absolutely see what you mean, and I have rarely run into a case where I've walked into a place and they had seating on the floor, but most of the time, and since 1991, I mean, I was injured in 1985, so I was pre-ADA, so I have, in all these years, really, I get the idea of an accessible table or non-accessible table, i.e. making sure there's at least a few tables that are a little higher. But when you talk about high tops, now you're making it, you're changing the whole ballgame. You're no longer saying, yeah, I have an accessible table that's really comfortable for your wheelchair. You're now saying, I have entire areas where your wheelchair cannot go, period. There's a difference. So, you know, I understand what you're meaning. The law was really written for accessible tables, where all the tables were not high tops back then, because we didn't have high tops then. High tops became a trend probably really high.
Yes, and that's what I said earlier, that 5% rule and all that stuff, when they devised all these things, it was based on non-high top tables. So
right.
And that they really have to look at that. My ideal would be that you go into a place and where before they have a bar, and that bar is completely inaccessible, it's all too high, that bar now has a lower section. And when you go and you look on the left-hand side, where before they had a series of high-top tables, now, not at the end, or, you know, not off to the side, but in the center, in the heart of the action, they removed the high-top table, and they put the same type of table, just not a high top. In other words, the same type of lacquer or teak or mahogany finish, whatever it might be, the same type of anchoring, the same type of legs, whatever beauty they put into their high top tables, they do the same for the accessible table. And if that's achieved, then that environment now is accessible to the maximum degree required by any law and new construction. So that's what we can do in court. These other things have to be done in terms of changing the mindset. That has to be done through public outreach, really. You have to get to the public. It's not...
You know, it's so
even the gay rights movement, that started with the public. And
yes.
Finally the courts had to fall into line. That's how that happened.
But we needed... See, the thing is, even with the gay alliances, I mean, it wasn't... If we don't have the support of the entire community, the non-disabled people to help us, you know, I think that we need to get petitions. We need to have them signed by everyone. And we need everybody to share these stories and to talk about them and share them on their walls, because it's an awareness thing. I'm not gay, but I certainly always shared, you know, the gay rights articles and books.
All the rights. Yeah, all the rights.
It's a civil rights issue.
As a young, I was a feminist before I even knew what the word was. I mean, I remember being chased down when I was 11 years old by the World Trade Center. When Betty Friedman and all these men were doing the burning their bras and doing it, and the construction workers down there were angry over the show and started chasing us. One of them caught me. I was scared. So I'm with the program. And I have to tell you about the able-bodied community. Yeah, they need to get behind it. But I would also say, most respectfully, that the disabled community really needs to make their voices heard in the numbers that they are, and be louder and be more active and proactive in asserting their rights and asserting what they need to do to get these things changed. Because if it doesn't happen within that community itself, it's not really going to take hold in the able-bodied community, you know?
I absolutely agree. And I think sometimes, you know, we do a lot of advocating, and, you know, the rights were fought for so hard by Justin Dart and all the other leaders in the disability community who made the ADA possible, the Americans with Disabilities Act, if anybody wants to look it up. But Louis, we really appreciate your time. We do have to close now. Can you please tell us, how would you recommend someone find you, first of all? Do you have a website, or is there an email or a phone number that someone who is interested in hiring an attorney or hiring an expert can locate you?
Yes, well, I don't keep a website. I'm not really out in the public because, I work with a select group of people because I can trust them. I know they're going to do it right. They're going to work with me. But they can get in touch with me by calling my number, 305-807-8369. I do believe I have a profile on LinkedIn, but I haven't looked at it in a number of years, but I think they can look me up there. They want to see a little background before they call me. I'm based in South Florida, and I'd be very happy to assist anyone, and I do all the time.
Thank you, Louis. And also, if you do want to follow the story, and we will be continually reporting on these issues, we'd love to hear your comments as well. You can write us at contactus@pushliving.com. And you can also go to pushliving.com and you can upload your own photos of high top tables where you have been discriminated. We want to know the name of the location, the city, and a photo of the high top table where you were denied access. And that means, generally speaking, and you will find it, like Louis and I were talking, the high top tables are where the action is. The high top tables are where the views are. And that's where we are now denied access. So we need to now refight this battle and start over again and say, hey, you know, somehow these snuck in there and we need to get rid of them. But it's not just high top table, folks. In closing, Louis handles things like concerts. If you find that you go to concerts and you don't have access, there aren't enough accessible seating, or the people who are using them are not people with disabilities, and you know that they're fraudulently being purchased. He also deals with issues like sidewalks. In a new construction where you can't get into, you know, a brand new apartment facility or even a condo that you go into, and they're saying that, you know, you don't have the right parking and you can't use a lift for the pool. He also deals with issues like parking, if there isn't enough parking spots, or they're not the correct type of parking that you need for your van, the correct width, etc. So there's a lot of other issues that are regarding the ADA that we can deal with, and we'd love to help you, and thank you so much, Louis, for your time.
Been a pleasure, Deborah. Thank you so much, really.
Thank you. And thank you, audience, for listening. Till the next time.
All right. Bye-bye. Keep up the good work. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
This podcast is sponsored by Push Living Photos, because using disability images in your marketing will help you create a positive and inclusive brand. When you buy Push Living Photo stock images, you get great photos of real people, and you can feel good knowing that your purchase is helping to change lives. This is the only stock image library that not only pays their photographer royalties, but also pays their models with disabilities for each sale. For them, this could mean help with out-of-pocket medical expenses, wheelchairs, home modifications, adapted vehicles, and more. The benefits are as diverse as our models. Show the world you care about people living with disabilities. Visit our website to purchase stock photos, join our team of models, or register to become a photographer. PushLivingPhotos.com.